Wait for the blue light. All right, I'm going to call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. Good afternoon. Joe Gallegos underwent some changes and in his committee schedule, and so he is no longer on our committee. And so I'd like to welcome our new member, Susan McClain. And just if you want to tell the audience here and those watching at home where you're from, your district, and anything else.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Susan McClain, and I'm the representative from West Washington County. And I live in Forest Grove, and my district takes in Cornelius, Forest Grove, and the west part of Hillsboro. And I've been a teacher for 42 years, and this is my new experience.
Wonderful. So we are going to very quickly do a work session on a bill. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2843. And Wendy, do you want to give us a reminder of that bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2843 authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to enter into an interagency agreements with the Construction Contractors Board for the board to perform duties on behalf of the department related to the State Building Code. The bill also authorizes the Construction Contractors Board to enter into interagency agreements with the Department of Consumer and Business Services for the department to perform duties on behalf of the board. The bill declares an emergency as effective upon passage, has been found to have no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2843 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield has made a motion to move House Bill 2843 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, will you please call the roll?
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bueller?
Excused.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. And so seeing that, the bill passes. Do you think that Representative Barbara Smith Warner probably wants to carry this? Okay. We'll have Representative Barbara Smith Warner carry it. And we will, since we had this on the work session for last, we will reopen the record when Representative Bueller shows up so that he's able to take a vote on the record as well. And with that, this morning we are going to, or this afternoon, we're going to start out with an informational hearing on personal injury protection and underinsured motorist coverage. A hearing from DCBS and then Rob Dalton. So first we'll have, I'm going to open the informational meeting. And we'll have T.K. Keene and Eric Cutler from DCBS start us off.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. My name is T.K. Keene, and I'm the Acting Deputy Administrator of the Oregon Insurance Division. Along with me today is Eric Cutler. He's the manager of our rates and forms section, and also a subject matter in auto insurance coverages. Today, he's going to go over, we're both going to address topics related to the required and optional coverages of auto insurance that are available in Oregon, personal injury protection, and uninsured and underinsured motorists. We've provided to you a copy of a PowerPoint presentation that will track Eric's presentation. And with that, I will go ahead and turn the presentation over to Eric.
Thank you, TK. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Cutler. I'm also with the Oregon Insurance Division. I'm the Rates and Forms Manager there, and we do thank you for this opportunity to give this information for your benefit. If you refer to the PowerPoint, that's pretty much what I'm going to follow. On slide two is kind of where I'm going to start. And basically in Oregon, these are the required coverages for an auto policy: bodily injury, property damage, personal injury protection, uninsured motorist, and underinsured motorist coverage. And we'll cover that a little bit more in detail. So as I roll along, we'll try to give some more examples. So on the next slide, bodily injury and property damage, that really makes up the guts of the basis of an auto policy. That's what's divided. That's what the first auto policies that came out, that was really the meat of the potatoes, was to protect you know, if you had an automobile and you hurt somebody, to protect those people. So when you see the word injuries, that's bodily injury. Where you see the word property on that handout, that's property damage. That's what they're designed to do. We set a minimum coverage amounts, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and they're set by law. But there are widely higher limits available throughout the marketplace. Okay. Then next slide. Bodily injury minimum limits in the state of Oregon, per person, it's $25,000 per person. It's $50,000 per accident. Legal fees are typically covered and are outside of limits, if that makes any sense. To give a little bit of example, per person is subject for every person that were injured. So if you were at fault and hurt another person in their car, they have 15 people in that car, they're only going to get $25,000 per person, subject to a $50,000 limit. And that's the minimum limits. So it's not a lot of coverage. So just that's the minimum. So you, again, there's higher limits that are widely available. Property damage by itself, it covers damage to other people's property. You hit a fence, you hit somebody else's car. That's what property damage is for, is to make that whole. Pretty straightforward. And the minimum limit for that in the state of Oregon is $20,000. Personal injury protection, or PIP, as it's usually called, it's Oregon's version of a no-fault insurance coverage. It provides medical services, and it's really regardless who is at fault. The minimum level that's required in Oregon is $15,000. It's primary over health insurance coverage, and also federal law requires PIP to be primary to any federally funded health care coverage, and that treating PIP otherwise can jeopardize those federal funds. We're probably talking Medicare and that. So that's something of note there with PIP.
Excuse me, I'm just going to interrupt you really quickly.
Yes.
So we're actually going to listen to the entire presentation, or would you guys also prefer that we're able to ask questions during? Okay, so let's listen to the entire presentation, at least from one presenter, and then maybe take questions on the presentation and then the other. So sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to – I felt a question bubbling inside of me, and then I realized I probably should tell other people that we need to wait till the end. So please continue.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. So where was I? Some additional details about PIP. There's loss of earnings coverage, and there's some detail on that to give you some more meat to that, maximum of $3,000 in the weeks provided. Essential services, a lot like loss of earnings, except for it's for things for somebody who's not employed but could lose some essential things, that daily living things, so it provides some coverage for that. Funeral expenses, child care is also typically covered, and the limits are stated there typically, so very straightforward. Uninsured motorists, UM. I like to use UM and UIM, so forgive me. So uninsured motorists is UM. Underinsured motorists is UIM. I mangle those, so I try to use the acronym, so forgive me. Coverage for bodily injury to you and your passengers. Basically, what it is designed to do is provide coverage for you, the insured, the owner of the policy, when somebody doesn't have an insurance or they don't have enough. So that's the really basic description of what UM and UIM do, and we'll get in a little bit more detail. The minimum coverage for it, not surprisingly, follows along with the minimum coverage limits for bodily injury. So it's $25,000 per person, $50,000 per accident. Again, that's a minimum. And again, the insurance company is designed to function a lot like the other person's bodily injury if they don't have any or if they don't have enough. Uninsured motorist coverage is identical at level as your BI unless you elect lower. So if you don't, to get, say you have high limits but you want to elect lower, you can, but you can't go below the state minimum required limits, if that makes any sense. UIM or underinsured motorist has to match your UM, so if they function, they flow the same way. So if you elect lower UM, you are going to have to elect lower UIM. They follow each other. So if for these coverages, they'll always be the same limit, okay? And again, I would like to give an example. That we have that last bullet. Benefits are paid to an insured at an amount equal to uninsured motorist coverage less the amount recovered from an auto liability policy of an at-fault party. So the key word in there is less. And UM is the easy one. And that is where I'm going to use a very, very simplistic example, so forgive me if this is too basic. But say you carry only $25,000 of UM coverage on your policy. The at-fault party that hits you, injures you, just you, they don't carry anything. They have no coverage at all. That's where your UM steps in and acts like their liability. So they would have $25,000 worth of coverage available for that accident. Under UIM, and this is again current law as we speak today, UIM, I'm going to use a little bit different example. Say you carry $50,000 of UIM coverage, uninsured motorist coverage. The other party has $25,000 worth of bodily injury coverage, same accident. The amount that would be available to you would still only be $25,000 because it'd be your $50,000 UIM limit less the recoverable $25,000 from their liability, which would equal $25,000. So that's kind of the simplest way I could break that down. And just want to, that this was a good spot to give that example. I saw another question, Will, and that's good. Stacking, we were asked to provide some information in relation to UIM and stacking of underinsured motorist coverage. And this is a concept that differs than what's current, so this is not current law. And what it would do, instead of paying the difference between your coverage and the coverage of the at-fault driver, your underinsured benefits would stack or be on top of the bodily injury coverage of an at-fault driver. And I'll give you the same, I'll try to use the same example to give you how that would be different. Again, the easy ones, UM, underinsured motorist coverage, the other person doesn't have any coverage, you're going to get what you bought. You're going to get the $25,000 limit that you bought. Under a UIM example, he purchases $50,000 worth of UIM, underinsured motorist coverage. The other person has $25,000, the state minimum. What you would be available to you would be $75,000. And how that would work would be your $50,000 limit plus the recoverable $25,000 limit of liability from the other adverse party. So you get a net of $75,000. So. Now, there are other optional coverages, and we didn't list them all. It's a very competitive market space, and there's literally potentially hundreds of optional coverage you can buy in auto anymore. So we stuck to the kind of ones your constituency would probably ask you about. Comprehensive, collision, they're all optional. Your constituency is going to probably call it full coverage. It's not typically really full coverage. The industry will correct me on that. But the people you talk to will call it this. And it's just so you know what this is. Collision basically pairs for, repairs if an insured is hit or get hit by another vehicle or object. So collision basically takes care of your car, less a deductible, if it's in a collision. It's really simply if you hit something or hit, collision's going to be important, less a deductible. Comprehensive really is other than collision. That's really the good way to look at it. It pays for damages in the event other than a collision. A good example, your car catches on fire. Someone steals your car. That's going to be where other than collision or comprehensive comes into play, less a deductible that you select. These are not required by law, but if you buy a brand new car, you probably have had the dealer tell you got to have this coverage. So it's pretty typical coverage. Another interesting one that's out there is guaranteed asset protection or GAP. You probably heard it as GAP coverage. And the easiest way for me to describe it is that when you buy a brand new car, the minute you drive it off the lot, it is a used car. And you could be underwater instantly the minute you drive off the lot. And what this kind of coverage does is try to fill in that gap a little bit. Coordination of auto and health benefits. Auto and health insurers can establish a lien against any recovery for non-economic damages that the insured receives from an at-fault driver. The lien is limited by expenses, costs, and attorney fees incurred by the injured person. And for me, non-economic, I have to always write this out. It's bottom line. It's stuff you can put a dollar amount to, like wages, medical costs, that sort of thing. What it's not referring to would be pain and suffering, loss of consortium, that sort of thing, if that makes some sense. So. And lastly, Oregon's a proof of insurance state. You're required to show proof of insurance. It's typically done through a valid insurance card. The carriers have this down very well. It can be electronic in the state of Oregon. And it can be by these other methods as well. But I'd say by a valid insurance ID card is probably 99% of the personal auto businesses covered by that. And with that, that's our brief overview, and we'd be glad to take any questions.
Okay, is there any questions based off this first presentation? Yes, Representative Holdy.
Thank you. Let me see if I can find the slide. When you were talking about the additional coverages under the PIP, I believe.
Page 10. Page 9 and 10.
Page 7, PIP additional coverage. So do those coverages come out of the PIP amount, or are they actually additional on top of?
No, they would be included in the actual amount of purchase. They are coverages that are included within that amount. You can buy higher amounts of PIP, but they would be covered under that limit.
So in the $15,000 follow-up? Sorry. So in the...
Forgive me. Representative Holby, I got to get my protocol down. I apologize. There's also sublimits on there.
There's what?
There's sublimits on there as well, sir. So, for example, it's subject to the limit of the $15,000, but there's also a maximum of a $3,000 sublimit for 52 weeks for loss of earnings, so there'll be sublimits within that limit.
I guess I'm trying to figure out, does that, if you have that maximum $3,000 additional, is that included in the $15,000 minimum?
I believe it's included into the coverage provided.
So if I bought the $15,000 minimum and I wanted these additional coverages, it would come out of the $15,000?
I believe that's going to be Representative Rayfield, you have it.
Yeah, and just to kind of chime in, it wouldn't come out of the $15,000. So you could have, my understanding of the PIP coverage is that, for instance, if you had a year's worth of wage loss, that could well exceed the $15,000. The $15,000 is purely only for medical expenses. No.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Do you have a follow-up to Representative Rayfield?
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Rayfield, are you sure?
I am sure.
Okay, that's all I needed.
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, thank you for the correction. You are right. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Other questions? So one question I had is on, I mean, the page doesn't matter, but page 9, when you were describing current law, that if we're in an accident and I've paid premiums for $50,000 of coverage, let's say that Representative Rayfield hits me, he's been paying premiums for $25,000 of underinsured coverage, and my medical, my injuries are, say, $80,000 or $75,000. You said that I only get the 50, even though he's been paying premiums for 25 and I've been paying premiums for 50. Is it that I actually don't get it, or is there some kind of, I first have to reimburse the insurance, or that he has to reimburse my insurance company? I mean, am I actually just not getting his coverage, or is he paying back my insurance company for the first $25,000, meaning that I still really only get $50,000? I just want to understand technically how that works.
Sure. Chair Fagan, how it works is it's going to be a net effect. So you are going to get the benefit. I would say typically... the $25,000 auto liability limit, if he's truly at fault, everybody agrees, that's in play. But it's going to be a net effect of your UIM limits, so it would subtract out. So you're not going to get the 75 of a stack. You would get basically, a good way to do the math was you have a limit of $50,000 of UIM limits available, and if there's $25,000 net there from the other party, you're going to get the net of those two. And current law.
Right. So I understand that from go ahead.
Sorry.
No, please.
Your second follow-up was that the premiums based on, from the carriers would be based on that net effect, if that makes any sense.
It makes sense. It's not exactly what I was asking. So what I'm asking is, no, it's okay. I wasn't clear. So what I'm trying to figure out is there an exchange between my two insurance companies? So in theory, actually, his insurance company is paying out $25,000, right? He's just paying it to my insurance company, not actually to my medical bills.
Chair Fagan, typically the claim, I'm not an expert on claims, but typically the claims adjustment process would be that the at-fault party is liable. They do have to pay. There would be a payment from their company to cover your loss. And then that definitely comes into play first. Yes.
But they're paying my insurance company.
They right. could be, if they paid your claim, yes.
Okay, that was a technicality for me. Other questions or comments? No? Okay, let me see if I had. Oh, sorry. Or you can go ahead and go as well.
That was the presentation.
Oh, that was the presentation. Okay, I didn't know if there was other.
There's not a second part. Yeah.
Questions? Yes, go ahead.
Just clarify one thing. So in Oregon, if you have the minimum underinsured motorist limits, you pay a certain portion of your premium is actually itemized for underinsured motorist benefits. Is that right?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, that would be correct. To how that split and represented carrier by carrier would be very difficult to detail, but in a rate-making process, yes, that they do get, that would be a fair assessment.
And then one follow-up.
Yeah.
The other question I would have is if someone has the minimum underinsured motorist limits and they're hit by somebody with the minimum bodily injury limits, is there an ability for that person to recover any underinsured motorist coverage?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, the way that would net out, so your scenario is you, the insured, carry $25,000 of UIM. The at-fault party only carried the minimum of $25,000. The available limits would be to $25,000. Mm-hmm. And availability, to my knowledge, there are other recourses outside of insurance for that, but in the insurance contract, the answer would be no.
So there's no situation in Oregon where if you have the minimum underinsured motorist benefits that you're paying for a premium each month that you would ever be able to recover that benefit?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, under your exact scenario, the answer would be no.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I'm trying to think if I have any other questions before. I mean, because we talked earlier today, and one thing, I guess, I know the answer, but since I didn't know the answer before talking to you, just for the benefit of the panel, could you talk a little bit about how insurance rates are set, that it's not so much like health insurance where there's this whole kind of rate review in you, but it's actually, I mean, I always, you know, you guys have taken about 15 minutes, and I'm not sure if you've saved me 15% or more, but, you know, I feel like I change insurance every month or so because there's so much competition driving those rates down, which is a good thing. So can you talk a little bit about how those rates are actually set?
Chair Fagan, I'll make an attempt at that. Insurance carriers definitely do file their rates with us, but we are a file-and-use state when it comes to rates, and we do review them. But it's a very competitive environment. They're incented to, because of that competition, to keep their rates as competitive as possible. But they also have obligations for their surplus, obligations for many things. And one of them, I think we discussed, was return on their investment. You know, they're for-profit organizations. That information largely would be included in a rate filing of what they're trying to do and where they're trying to go with that. It's an actuarial process, which I'm not equipped to talk about or qualified to talk about. So that would be a filing process in the state of Oregon. We are prior approval on the forms, however, but on the rates, we are a file and use approach, but we do review them.
Okay.
So did that?
Yeah, that just was useful to me to understand, so thank you very much.
Sure.
Is there anything that you want to add in particular that was?
No, not based on our discussions. I think we
okay.
covered it all.
Great.
So, yep.
Are there any other questions or comments for this panel before we let them loose? Yes, Representative Holby.
Just to follow up, I'm just still trying to absorb Representative Rayfield's question about the scenario where he's paying premiums for insurance and under certain scenarios in an accident, you end up getting nothing.
Right.
And so how is that, you know, so what happens to your... to the insurance that you're paying for. I mean, why are you getting nothing in
sure.
that scenario?
So, Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey, one of the questions that we would have about that scenario is the frequency that that actually occurs. And so I think that one of the things that we would want to look at would be how many times that situation specifically would happen. And then Eric,
that doesn't answer, excuse
Eric
me.
May have more details as far as specifically what happens to that block of insurance that you've paid into.
Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey, I actually don't really have a good answer for that right now. It's a little beyond the scope of my presentation. We could certainly go back and do some research and come back and answer your question a little more in depth. We're not here to answer kind of a policy approach. It's kind of what is. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to get too far out of bounds on that. But we certainly could give it a shot to kind of maybe explain that more in technical detail.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Well, I'm just kind of wondering about, you know, when consumers enter into contracts for insurance coverage and they're paying premiums, and there happens to be these scenarios where they don't get coverage. I think they believe that their contract should be providing a benefit for. And I'm just wondering how that legally exists. I mean, is that not something that the insurance division approves these sorts of, I guess, insurance contracts? And so you're approving a contract that allows somebody to pay premiums that in many instances they do not recover a benefit?
So, Representative Fagan, Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey, many times there's certain minimum coverage that we're required by statute to review these policies for. Beyond that, there are certain optional coverages that consumers and insurance companies can enter into for additional benefits. One thing that we do try to do is cover the maximum amount of coverages and ensure that consumers are fully informed on what they're purchasing so that there aren't situations where someone believes that they're purchasing something and they're not, in fact, getting a benefit back. I would be happy to research for you further the frequency of the scenario that you described, just to see if there's anything that we have done research-wise in the rate review process or that isn't fully covering consumers. And I have to say, just in being involved in the policy discussions, I don't believe that offhand that volume of complaints on the topic of coverage is not covering in auto what they were expecting. As far as breaking out by specific area, would address that specific scenario, but I can find out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. It just baffles me that we have legal insurance contracts that are approved by the insurance division that allow people to pay premiums for a benefit that they may not get. I don't know. I just think there's something fundamentally wrong with that. Troubling. So, anyway.
Thank you, Representative. And on a technical level, if I understood your answer to my previous question correctly, in that scenario, the at-fault person's insurance is still paying that $25,000. They're just paying it to my insurance company, who probably maybe initially paid some bills, and so my insurance company is getting paid back its $25,000, even though I've paid a premium before I actually, you know, that's where the exchange of money is actually happening, is between insurance companies, not between, you know, the at-fault driver's insurance company and the person who's injured. In that scenario, that $25,000 to $25,000, is that accurate? You don't have to comment necessarily on the policy of it, but
Chair Fagan, that's very typical. To add on to that, it's called subrogation. So they will many times, carriers will, through their UM coverage, they will pay the coverage, and then they'll subrogate against the other carrier.
Okay. Thank you. Another question.
And so I just had a question. What percentage of policies issued in the state of Oregon are minimum policies? And how many people would, how many drivers is that?
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, I don't have that information at hand, but I can certainly research that and get back to you.
Yeah, and the reason I ask that is Representative Holvey was trying to figure out, well, how many of these folks have the minimum coverage in Oregon, which means they have the minimum underinsured motorist benefits, which means no matter what
collision they're involved in Oregon, they can't get, they will not ever be able to get that benefit of that coverage. And if we could find out how many people actually have the minimum coverage, then we could say if it was 27%, 40%, you know, then you'd be able to say, okay, 40% of Oregon drivers aren't able to actually access this coverage that they're paying for.
I agree that that data would be very helpful if you guys can get that for us.
Sure. Chair Fagan, we will try to get that data for you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Well, I think we thoroughly, I told you to take, I think that there was about 10 minutes for the presentation, but 10 minutes for questions. So thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation. Thank you for your thoroughness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so with that, we're actually going to have one more piece of invited testimony, which is Rob Dalton from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
Thank you very much, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk to you today about Senate Bill 411. I'm on the front line. I work out in Clackamas, and the people who come to see me have been in car accidents. Many times, I'm the very first person that they talk to. And so I am many times the person who delivers the very bad news about Oregon law as it currently exists with respect to underinsured motorist benefits. It's our goal with this legislation to allow consumers to get what they paid for. It's true that every policy contains the provisions that were discussed by the representative from the Department of DCBS. And this bill only deals with two of those parts. Those are underinsured motorist benefits and PIP. The underinsured motorist coverage only applies when there is inadequate coverage in the at-fault party's policy to fully compensate you. Let's use an example from real life. One of my clients, a man by the name of Justin Caputo, was on his way from a friend's house with his girlfriend out near Vernonia. It was late, 10 o'clock in the evening. He actually was asleep in the front seat and she was driving. A drunk driver crossed the center line and hit them head on. Hit them head on at such high speed that his abdomen, the guts in his abdomen, literally exploded on impact. His colon was ruptured. His spleen was torn. He had some intestinal damage. Obviously, he went to the hospital as a result of that injury. His initial set of bills were $75,000. He came to me and assumed that he would be able to access the insurance company of the vehicle he was in on his underinsured motorist benefits, that being $25,000. The drunk driver also had $25,000. So even if he got both, that would be $50,000, and he would be behind, if you will, or out, around another $25,000 in medical bills. Sadly, as you've just heard, under Oregon law, he's only entitled to $25,000 from the at-fault. His underinsured motorist is completely unavailable to him. So in addition to being severely injured, lost his job, he also had his credit destroyed. That's what the net effect of this is. And you might wonder for a second, well, what happens to those unpaid bills? So instead of having $50,000 to apply to his bills, he only has $25,000. Here's what happens to them. All of us taxpayers end up paying them. If we don't pay them, they get written off. And often they get written off by small businesses, doctors, chiropractors, naturopaths, acupuncturists, folks who run little businesses and rely on payments from their patients to make ends meet. I submit to you that that is not a proper result. I would like at this time to ask Ms. Malone to play a video for you. And this is a video from a woman by the name of Dee Dee McElhaney. Ms. McElhaney was on the way back from Central Oregon to her Portland home with her two daughters in the car. They were out in Central Oregon, kind of near the town of Prineville, actually, when a vehicle crossed the center line and exploded the front of her car. Literally, the engine itself, the block and the engine, were ejected from the vehicle and landed almost 100 feet away, apparently. Huge forces. She was severely injured. She had both legs broken. She had a broken hip. She was hospitalized for an extended period of time. Her business was being a kindergarten teacher. She actually had purchased $100,000 in coverage, so she had opted for a higher level of coverage. And as you can see on the chart over here, her medical bills, the blue line at the top, totaled somewhere in the $300,000 range. Under current law, she's able to pick up the policy limit of the adverse driver, who also had $100,000, matching limits. What she couldn't get is the cream-colored little bar there, which is the $100,000 that she had paid for. When she went to see her lawyer, she was shocked to find out that she only had $100,000 coverage to pay her bills instead of the $200,000 she assumed that she did. The bottom number, if you will, or bottom line on that chart is entitled Get What You Paid For. And that's what this bill does. It says she should get the $100,000 from the adverse. She should get the $100,000 from her own policy, making $200,000. Is she ahead? No, she's still minus somewhere around $100,000 in her medical bills alone. And she's out her wage loss and the huge disruption of her life. But current law denies her even the basic fairness of getting the coverage that she paid for.
Yes.
If that's the point, what law? Can you tell us what that law says?
Yes.
That's what I think we all need to know what that law is to understand your presentation.
It's under ORS 742.500, mm-hmm. and then it's got many parts. But I can paraphrase it best. Current law says that you're entitled to recover underinsured motorist benefits only if your underinsured motorist policy limit is greater than that of the underlying at-fault party.
Okay.
So that's where this example comes from. Because their limits were equal, $100,000 in each policy, under Oregon law, she is completely unable to access that coverage. And then there's been a Court of Appeals case, Perkins, which is what we call it, and that Perkins case has said that that law is constitutional as written, and that's why we need to change it, is because the law is quite clear that there's no right to recover in Ms. McElhaney's situation. So can we show the video?
Yes, please.
Great, thanks.
On October 30th, 2011, I was in an automobile accident. It was a head-on accident. I had a driver coming towards me on Highway 26.
Can people hear that?
Yeah.
Two-lane highway. And I saw her coming and saw her veer off the side of the highway, and she overcorrected, and she came into my lane and hit me head-on. And ended up having me trapped in the car. My children were also in the vehicle, and we were knocked off the highway, and I had to be cut out of the vehicle with jaws wide. As you can imagine, 23 nights in the hospital was quite a bit of money. The titanium that's in my legs and my hip amounted to about $35,000 itself. That's without doctor expenses or anything. Then, of course, the surgery, 23 nights in the hospital, it came out to about $285,000. I ended up using up my limit on my physical therapy, so I ended up having to spend money out of my own pocket for physical therapy. I spent about $1,000 out of my own pocket to cover what was not covered with my insurance. When I found out about the car insurance, I had paid all of my premiums, and I had my uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage of $300,000, which I thought would go into play when somebody did not have enough coverage to pay for medical
expenses.
So
you actually paid for the extra coverage.
So I paid for extra coverage, yes. In Oregon, I'm only required to carry, I believe it's $25,000. And the gal that hit me had $100,000 coverage. So when I heard that her $100,000 was not adequate, I thought, okay, well then my insurance will kick in and pay the rest. And I found out that's not so. And so I was left then with another $185,000 to try to figure out how to pay for it. And so, you know, when I was trying to heal, and when I hear this news, it was just devastating. And, you know.
So how did you get through it?
With a lot of help from family. I have to live with family. Try to struggle, as you can see.
Absolutely, it's emotional.
Reliving it still 3 years later.
So, you're speaking to a room full of legislators right now. What would you like them to know? What would you like them to do?
Well, I'd like them to pass this bill so other people, they don't have to go through what I've gone through. It's enough when you're dealing with such a tragedy. This was a fatal accident. I had to deal with the psychological effects. In fact, the 17-year-old girl was killed in the accident. It was an accident that was not my fault. I shouldn't have had to pay a dime for anything. I've paid enough having to go through the emotional trauma. But then I also had to go through the financial aspect of things. And I just don't want to see other people go through it.
Thank you very much. Sorry about the difficulty hearing. I don't know what's wrong with the audio on that. Sorry. You might wonder, how does our law, which denies consumers any coverage, any availability of the coverage that they paid for in a matching limits situation, how does that compare with the rest of the country? Our research shows us the vast majority, I believe the correct number is 37, that allow stacking. I've heard from the insurance industry numbers in the high 20s, but it's one or the other. At any rate, it's a majority. So by adopting Senate Bill 411, we would bring Oregon in accordance with the majority of the states that allow consumers to get what they paid for with regard to UIM benefits. I want to talk about the number of cases this applies to and why, frankly, why the impact on premiums will not be very significant overall. It only applies to serious injury cases. A couple of sessions ago, one of the representatives from, I believe it was Safeco, one of the insurance companies came in, and we were testifying that day on a bill that amended ORS 20.080, which some of you may remember is the small case civil compromise statute. And we raised that limit up as a result of that legislation from 5,500 as a maximum that would keep these cases out of court to 10,000. And one of the reasons that we were able to do that is that representative testified that the industry believes over 90% of all cases are resolved for less than $10,000. So we're talking about a small slice of the overall picture to start with, only about 10% of the cases that would go beyond $10,000. I can tell you from my own practice, and that's 30 years of doing virtually nothing but auto accident cases, I can tell you it's a tiny percentage. Most folks can be accommodated, can be made completely whole as to all their injuries, their medical bills, their wage loss, and an amount to cover the interference with their normal activities of life under $25,000, which is that minimum policy. So we're talking about a tiny slice of a tiny slice, a very small number of cases. Why is it important then if it's only such a small number of cases? Because those are the folks who need it. Those are the folks who are catastrophically injured, like Mr. Caputo, like the fellow I told you about who only had $25,000 to apply towards his medical bills and frankly nothing to live on. while he recovered from his injuries. The other part of the law, moving along, is deals with PIP, personal injury protection benefits. You've just heard about that. And PIP has two components. I'll try to be clear as to what it really does. One of them provides a minimum coverage of $15,000 or currently 1 year, whichever comes first, when it will pay your medical bills. And those medical bills that get paid are those that are reasonable and medically necessary. It also has a wage loss component, and that wage loss component used to be $1,250 a month until 2011 when we increased it to $3,000 a month. In a very serious injury case where someone was off for the entire 52-week period that it applies to, theoretically, that person could collect up to $36,000 in PIP wage loss. That's $3,000 a month for a year. Current law provides that your own insurance company that pays this PIP gets their money back before you get a penny as the victim, unless economic damages alone exceed all available proceeds. What do we mean by economic damages? Just what I talked about, medical bills, wage loss, in terrible cases, burial expenses, things like that. We propose in this legislation to change really just one word in the statute, and that one word is the word economic will be replaced by the word total. The effect of that is that the consumer will stand first in line and be made whole as to all their losses, not just medical bills and not just wage loss, before the insurance company is entitled to be reimbursed. The other change that the law makes in PIP law is it changes from 1 year to 2 years the amount of time that you have to use that $15,000 in coverage. And my understanding is this actually was proposed first, I believe, 4 years ago. And it was Representative Hovey's constituent that brought this to our attention, that some folks, even though they don't burn through the whole 15, still have a need to go to physical therapy or complete a therapy regimen that might extend into the second year after the accident. And so this law has the effect of giving you up to a full 2 years to use up the $15,000. It does not increase coverage by one penny, just the time in which you can access it. And I can tell you from my own practice, that is a almost non-existent number of people who, it's a very, very small number of people that this will ever apply to. But the cost factor is zero for the insurance company because the dollar figure stays exactly the same. I do have one other thing I'd like to talk to you about, and that is there were some arguments raised against our bill over on the Senate side, and I want to address those. First, it was suggested that the Oregon Health Plan, the ACA, somehow took away this problem, took away the devastation that is caused by our present anti-stacking provision. It's not true. The ACA does not pay people's living expenses, does not pay their wages, does not give them money to keep their lives going. All it does is cover medical bills, and it doesn't even cover all the medical bills. It covers the amount after a copay or after a deductible. So that is just an illusion that somehow the ACA obviates the need for this this law. Second, it's the standard argument that we hear every year. Rates are going to go through the roof. No one will be able to afford insurance. It's going to increase the number of uninsured motorists. I submit to you that that just isn't true. In 2009, we doubled the amount of money that was available for property damage from $10,000 to $20,000, probably because car values had gone up to where $20,000 wasn't necessarily even enough. But we doubled that number. At that point, we also raised PIP Medical from $10,000 to $15,000. At the time, the insurance industry, came in and told you rates were going to go through the roof. The sky would fall. Uninsured motorists would become the norm. It was a nightmare scenario that was painted by the insurance industry. I'm here to tell you none of that took place. The basic number of uninsured in Oregon has not changed in that period of time. Finally, we were attacked. Trial lawyers were attacked. And the argument was that somehow this bill is just a money grab for lawyers. It was a way we were going to get more attorney's fees. I will acknowledge that in certain cases, fees will be greater, but that's not the reason. I'm going to tell you the reason. Remember earlier, I told you I was the front line and that people came to see me first. I want to tell you a story about a fellow who actually testified in front of the legislature back when we were raising the minimum wage reimbursement from $1,250 to $3,000. He's a contractor. He was working building houses for people. He had a thriving business, had five or six employees. He got in a very severe accident. It ruined his shoulder, and he had to have surgery. He had had some financial problems, and he had a minimum limits policy. So did the guy who hit him. And he came in, and he told me that he was pretty sure, since the other side had already revealed that it was a minimum limits policy, that he could get that money. And he wanted to know what I could do to get him the other $25,000 from his own policy right away, because he needed that money to live on. Remember, he was only going to get $1,250 in wage reimbursement at that time. That wasn't enough to pay his mortgage, much less keep his business going, feed his family, keep his kids in college. He had expenses. He had figured out that if he got his surgery right away and he had that $50,000, 25 and 25, he'd be able to make it. Big man, you know, real strong guy. I told him, no, doesn't work that way. You'll only get the 25 from the adverse. And really, I told him I couldn't help you. He'd probably get that without my help. He looked at me, and it dawned on him what I was saying. And he just sat there with a dumbfounded expression. Tears started to come down his eyes because he knew he was going to lose his house and he was going to lose his business. That's what this law is about, justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dalton. And particularly after that presentation, I'm very proud to note that he is a constituent of mine. So welcome very much. So I want to have about 5 minutes for questions. I'm assuming, can you come back on Tuesday when we have the hearing for the bill? Even if, I don't know if you're going to present, but even to be here for questions, then are you planning on coming Tuesday?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So we'll do about 5 minutes for questions. We still have some other hearings today, but he will also be here on Tuesday when we actually hear the bill as well. So Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. A couple questions on various components of your proposal or of your testimony. I'm looking at this example, and I do want to just clarify and make sure I'm understanding properly that under current law, if this example on the board over there, if the at-fault driver only had $25,000 worth of coverage instead of the $100,000, then the insurance on that would have still covered up to $100,000. Is that correct?
What happens in that scenario under present law is you would get $25,000 from the adverse and an additional $75,000 from your own, not $100,000. You'd only get $75,000 for a total of $100,000.
Right. And so I want to give you an opportunity to respond to this because I would imagine the insurance companies would say something along these lines. The quote get, or the title "Get What You Paid For," wouldn't an insurance company say you paid for $100,000 when all is said and done you got $100,000?
Well,
even though it came from different places.
I understand what you're saying, Representative Stark. However, what you're sold is $100,000 in underinsured motorist coverage. And in your example, what you're able to access is only $75,000. So I believe that that's improper and cheats the consumer, honestly.
One more brief. Yes. Thank you, Chair. And then you mentioned insurance rates and claims that they would increase and so forth. You also mentioned, I think you said, 37 states had adopted this sort of stack-in model.
That's what our research showed.
And do you have research on when this model was implemented over the next year or two, what those insurance rates in those states did?
I do not, no. Senator Gelser said on the floor of the Senate and in her testimony in the committee hearing was that she believed that her research showed that in some states insurance rates were marginally higher than in Oregon, and in others they were lower. And the implication there, I think, was that this doesn't seem to be a determinative factor on whether rates are lower or higher overall. In Washington, the rates are very comparable, and Washington has this law and has for decades. So there doesn't seem to be a direct correlation between rates and giving consumers the right to get what they paid for with respect to underinsured motorist coverage.
Thank you.
That prompts a question for me. So if I'm driving in Washington, even though I have the same policy, if I'm driving in Washington and I get hit by a Washington driver, in that situation, does their insurance company or does my insurance company still take the money from their insurance company, or do I get a stacking if I'm hit in Washington?
Excellent question. Let's assume you're an Oregon domiciliary, that you live in Oregon, and your policy is issued in Oregon. Even though you're driving in Washington, the underinsured motorist would be your access to underinsured motorists would be covered by Oregon law. So even though you were in Washington under current law, you would still be subject to the same subtraction as the DCVS representative put it. The fact that you're in Washington would not alter your insurance coverage.
Interesting. But if that Washington driver hit another Washington driver, there's a whole... So basically, Washingtonians should hit Oregonians in accidents.
In the scenario you laid out where a Washington resident hits a Washington resident, even if they were in Oregon when the accident happened, they would both have access to their full coverage, including stacking.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, Representative Holby?
not really a question, just perhaps a comment. I recognize that this is an informational hearing, and he was speaking about a bill that we're really not having a hearing on yet. And I was concerned that if the testimony from the woman that was on the video was intended to be testimony, that we somehow make sure that happens when we do have the public hearing.
We'll make sure.
I appreciate that. Yes, indeed. What we'll do is we'll get her audio transcribed and then have that entered into the record during the actual hearing.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Hagan. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. Thank you.
And just as a note, we did invite someone, a lobbyist from the insurance industry, to testify, but they declined that option. I think they'll be submitting written testimony for the informational hearing. So for that purposes, that's why we've not heard somebody from the insurance industry today. So with that, I will close the informational meeting on personal injury protection and underinsured motorist coverage and open a public hearing on House Bill 2238. And Wendy, will you give us a summary? And Representative Davis, do you want to go ahead and come forward?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2238 directs state agencies to make available on the Oregon Transparency website copies of reports that the agencies are required by law to produce within 30 days of the release of those reports. And I believe, I'm sorry, my notes are incomplete, but I believe there's no fiscal impact and maybe minimal. Actually, I believe that I do not yet have the fiscal.
It's a minimal.
It's a minimal. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a real pleasure to be here to testify in support of House Bill 2238. This really stems from my short experience as a legislator and the absolute volume of information we are presented with as legislators. Like many of you, I check my email on my phone on a constant basis. I'm probably along the average of most Americans with a smartphone about 80 times a day. Just for reference, at one 8:25 p.m. today, all of us received a flat fee study as directed by ORS 825482. And the absolute flood of these studies that are emailed to us legislators and the governor by state agencies and state boards and commissions got me to thinking, where would I go if I wanted to reference them later, if I didn't want to have my staff either print them out or create my own repository? And in some basic searching that I did, I found that I couldn't find an easy repository. And if I couldn't find it, I'm a decently tech-savvy guy, that my constituents and members of the public might have similar difficulty finding reports that we pay for as a state government that are required either by rule or by statute, that are made public to legislators or the governor, and then disappear into the ether. It's an area of sort of transparency and efficiency that became a concern to me. So I want to give thanks to my policy analyst and legal extern, Brianna Wellman, as I put her on this issue in developing this bill. She's been working with the State Library, the Department of Administrative Services, on finding what resources are out there and trying to develop an efficient way to get at this problem. Through that research, the State Library has been extremely helpful. They've partially answered it. There is currently a collaborative effort between the Oregon State Library and the legislative administration that they run a blog by the State Library that does post all of our reports that are presented to the legislature and emailed to us in a very prompt way. I think they show up there within about a day. So there is a resource there. To my understanding, they're not searchable yet, but at least we do have a blog-like list of the reports. But those are only reports issued to the legislature, and they're not currently listed on the Oregon Transparency website. So what this bill would do is, first and foremost, it would add a link or a repository on the Oregon Transparency website to all reports required by statute to be presented to the public. In our conversations with DAS, who you'll hear from in a moment, they've suggested some amendments that might eliminate any fiscal on this and sort of as a first step to get us where we need to go. In the investigation that my legal extern policy analyst did, the one thing it is concerning is we discovered that the governor's office has reported they have no repository. So the many reports that are required by statute or by rule to be issued to the governor, there's currently no way for the public to access in an easy way. We don't know if they're using a file somewhere in the governor's office. We don't know if there's a thumb drive somewhere or a hard drive somewhere in the governor's office where this information might be. We do know that when a governor retires or moves on, their records become part of the state archive, and that can sometimes be searchable. So Governor Kulongowski's reports and some of his records are available by archive with the state archives. Again, that's not a very consumer-friendly or public-friendly format. So this is really just a step designed to offer the public a way to access the information that we receive as legislators and as the executive branch on a daily basis. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions, and I'd also like to invite DAS up to testify as well and to answer questions.
Is there any questions for Representative Davis? Yes, Representative Nierman.
Maybe I should wait till DAS is done. I'll just take a stab at it. Thank you, okay. Madam Chair. Representative Davis, to your knowledge, is there any information in any of these reports that's privileged or confidential or shouldn't be seen outside the legislature or the executive branch?
Through the chair, Representative Nierman, to my understanding, no. There are reports required by to be made public anyway, so they're all public record to begin with.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Go ahead, Barry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Chief Operating Officer at the Department of Administrative Services, and I want to thank you for the chance to talk about this bill a little bit and the conversations we've been having with Representative Davis in his office. I wanted to give a little background on the Transparency website because I think it's important for you to understand the limitations that we operate that website under and the inherent tension that creates between the desire for greater transparency and the way the statute is actually constructed. When the legislature directed us to create the Transparency website, it actually put in the statute that we were to do so and to maintain it at no additional cost and without reallocating current resources. So it was essentially a make this free and keep it free. And so we did that largely by limiting the number of times we post information to the website and by not doing a lot of manipulation of reports or data that come. We just post a PDF or include a link to something. That has done well for the state. We've actually gotten very high rankings among transparency and government advocates for the amount of information we put on the transparency website. But we are getting to the point where the tension is becoming very strong between the desire to post more and more information on the website and our restriction from being able to use resources to do that. And so one of the conversations we've been having with Representative Davis is how do we do, you know, how could we accomplish this? How could we narrow the scope in such a way that we could try to make this workable? And I think there are two pieces in the bill that we would ask you to think about. First is the timing. So I mentioned one of the ways in which we manage the website now is to limit the amount of times we update it. So mostly it's an annual update of data. The bill right now says 30 days. Perhaps we could have some leeway around the agency's reporting, sending the report within 30 days, but then we can kind of accumulate them and post them at one point in time, something to think about. And then better defining report. I think to get to Representative Nierman's question, specifically identifying the reports that are required by statutes that are public, then we'll get around any sorts of questions around confidentiality or, there are exemptions in the transparency website right now for some economic development issues. So, being clear that it's all the public reports that are publicly available. Right now, state law requires agencies to publish those on their websites as it is. But you would have to know to go there and look for it. So I can certainly understand the desired outcome of having one place where you could go and find links. So that's really our suggestions today, is to think about narrowing the scope of the universe of reports. There are lots and lots and lots of things that could be considered reports, but if you narrow it to what's required by law and then consider the timing issue, we could continue those conversations. But I really did want to point out the restrictions in that statute. Finally, DAS was required last year to report to you on the transparency website and the desire of stakeholders to include certain information and what it would take to get to a better, more user-friendly site. It's also not particularly searchable, as Representative Davis has mentioned, in other areas as well. And so that report has been provided to you. I thought about bringing it to the committee, but
can I get online and search for that?
It's on the blog. You can get it that way as well. But I'd be happy to send the committee administrator a copy as well. But that does outline a series of steps that we could take with either changes in law, changes in systems, or additional resources to make the website more user-friendly and more searchable than it is right now. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Just a comment. So sounds like there's maybe some work to be done, but at least as it is written now, there is a minimal fiscal impact, minimal fiscal impact, but it's kind of like the problem is how much could you actually implement the bill by keeping that fiscal low, and not actually using additional resources or maybe, improving the website or whatnot. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we submitted an indeterminate fiscal to the Legislative Fiscal Office because we needed to have a better clarity around the scope of the volume of bills.
Okay. Yes, Representative Holby.
Yeah, I just want to thank Representative Davis for and Barry with DAS, Department of Administrative Services, for working on this. I am electronically challenged from time to time and, have had trouble accessing reports I know that exist. And so this is, and I know the website, the transparency website, has been ongoing project, and every session we've been making incremental improvements to this to make it better and better, and this is another step to make it better. So I appreciate you bringing it forward, and appreciate DAS and working to help make this a little bit better of a system.
Madam Chair, if I can make another comment. I think a suggestion has been made by DAS hopefully immediately or very soon, to include a link on the transparency website to the blog that's operated by Legislative Administration and the state librarians, because there is that at least resource. I think it would be nice to have that link. So we're in discussions about doing that, I think, regardless of whether or not this bill were to move forward. And I think the message with respect to the governor's office is simply we'll keep seeing. It's still extremely concerning to me that that office is receiving reports that apparently isn't going anywhere. So we'll keep on that.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Pack, first of all, I want to say thank you for that website, and thanks to Senator Thatcher, too, who I know helped to give birth to that. But a couple of months ago, I was just a regular old bumbling citizen and didn't have the rep.mikenierman email to catch all those reports and all that. So I very much used that website and appreciated it as a private citizen. And I appreciate Representative Davis's work on this. If you had the possibility, would you want some money to improve that website? And if so, what kind of, I mean, that's kind of an unfair question, but just go ahead and take a stab at it.
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, you know, I think as part of the report that I mentioned to you earlier that we emailed to you, we did a lot of interviews with stakeholders who worked with Senator Thatcher and Representative Hulvey and others in the creation of the website in the first place, and are often the folks who are advocating for more data, to ask them, what is it you would like, both in terms of data or information on the website, but also how the website runs itself. And so we got a lot of good feedback around ways in which we could make it more searchable, ways in which we could make it easier for the Joe citizen that doesn't have the rep.address to access. Those are things that we would be happy to do. We have a contract with the vendor that manages the state's website that would allow us to do that for a relatively low cost of staff time, were it not for the inhibition we have in statute to do that.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, just as a comment, it seems to me that while we obviously want to make it user-friendly to the public in general, the information itself is not very public friendly. I mean, I could certainly, you know, maybe I could, I mean, I read these results as a legislator, and I'm not even sure always what I'm reading, but it seems to me the most critical piece is the press is the one that will tend to, you know, if it's more user friendly, it's the press or kind of watchdog type groups that actually make a point of going out and figuring out how to actually understand the data and then communicating it away to the public that is more accessible. So, you know, I think part of the problem is that the typical public access to the internet is Google, which is so sophisticated and so good at such a great search engine, and there's no way to replicate that on, you know, I mean, you certainly could probably have a pretty large fiscal to create the state Google, but.
Yeah, could I make a comment
yes.
on that? Thank you, Chair. A good example of that, frankly, has to do with the ORS, Oregon Revised Statutes.
Oh, right.
It's issued in a text format by Legislative Council, a non-searchable text format. However, there is a private nonprofit law firm that has started OregonLaws.org and takes the text of that website, turns it into a Google searchable format in a way that's much more user-friendly for the public.
Right.
But that's a great example of how we've made the data public in a text format. It's been taken by a nonprofit and made searchable. And you can also Google it, of course, because Google adds it to their web spider. But that's just an example
right.
of what you're talking about.
Right.
Madam Chair, if I may, one other
yeah.
comment, too. I think there are at least five bills that I'm aware of right now this session that have requests for more information being posted on the transparency website. So the cumulative effect is
right.
also something that the committee, I would ask you to be aware of. But also, I think, back to Representative Nierman's question, our report really does sort of open a door to ask if the legislature wanted to be forward-thinking about where we want to take the website.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than a piecemeal approach,
right.
think about, do we want to actually devote a fairly modest resource? We're not talking millions of dollars. We're talking thousands of dollars, probably, to get it to the next stage. And what's the plan sort of longer term,
mm-hmm.
rather than just session by session by session, adding this little piece and that little piece? So.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Representative Davis. Thank you, Mr. Pack. Any other questions? All right. Wonderful. So it sounds like it still needs some work, so we'll just keep me posted on the work together. And
Madam
I will
Chair?
Yes.
Oh, I'll let you close the
Public hearing on House Bill 2238.
Madam Chair, before I forget, I'd like to make a motion.
Okay.
I'd like to make a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Bueller to cast a vote on the work session of House Bill 2843. So you vote on the motion to suspend the rules.
By a roll call?
You can ask for objection.
Okay. So Representative Holvey's made a very kind and nice motion to suspend the rules to reopen the vote on House Bill 2843 so that Representative Bueller can vote. Is there any objection? Okay. Seeing none, the motion carries. Will you please call its name?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Do you do anything? Representative, how do you vote?
Very good. So Representative Buehler votes yes. Great. Thank you very much for that. And we're actually going to call, we're going to open up the next four hearings concurrently. So because they're all dealing with the same, or the next four bills concurrently, because they're all dealing with basically the same subject matter. So I want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2910, 2911, 2912, and 2913. And if Ted and Judy want to go ahead and come forward. Was Bob Russell planning on coming and testifying on the last one?
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Wendy will actually do a quick summary. Excuse me, sorry.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, I'll just go through each bill briefly. House Bill 2910 repeals obsolete laws relating to agricultural experiment stations. House Bill 2911 repeals obsolete laws related to courts and constables, damages for Y2K computer failures, and enforcement of child support judgments. House Bill 2912 repeals obsolete laws related to transportation and motor vehicle laws. And lastly, House Bill 2913 repeals outdated and obsolete provisions and updates references related to human services programs. All four of the bills declare emergencies and are effective upon passage. And I believe most of these bills are found, or these bills are found to have no revenue impact, and I'm still waiting on fiscals for a couple, but I believe no fiscal impact as well.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ted Reutlinger with the Legislative Council's office, and with me is Judy Gears from the Department of Justice. And we're here to give you a brief description of what these four bills are about and where they came from and why they're before you today. They flow out of House Bill 4133, which the legislature passed in 2014. And what that bill did was direct legislative counsel and the Department of Justice to look at the statutory laws of the state, find provisions that are obsolete, outdated, and duplicative of other laws, and then to consider drafting bills to actually address the problems that we saw with each of those laws. What we did in consultation with the Department of Justice was prepare these bills in response to House Bill 4133. The bill required us with each bill to submit a report on the bill that explains exactly what we're doing in each section, why we're amending it, and why we're repealing it. And that report was required to be sent to all members of the legislature. Yeah, you received it on your email back in November. It's also posted on the Legislative Council website, and it's just a very long memo that looks just like this that tells you exactly what's happening in each section of each bill. Also in each bill, if you read it, below each section there's a note that tells you why the section's repealed, why it's amended. And that's unusual for bills other than the revisor's bill. And this report has to be entered into the legislative record, according to the law. These types of bills are only allowed to be filed in an odd-numbered year session, and the 2014 legislation is sunsetted in January of 2018, so that only the 2015 and 2017 sessions may consider these types of bills unless you extend that sunset. And so the process that we went through was for Legislative Council and the Department of Justice to consult with each other, with the governor's office, with state agencies, the judicial department, to try and identify good candidates for these bills. And the agency submitted suggestions to the governor and to Legislative Council and DOJ. The lawyers in both the executive and legislative department made suggestions, and we came up with four or five or six different bills to put various statutory changes into, drafted those up, sent them out to the agencies. The agencies carefully reviewed them, took out things that they didn't want included, added some additional things. We went through several iterations of this process and ended up with these four bills that everybody agreed met the statutory criteria, and the agencies all signed off on them before they went forward. And so the end result of that process are these four bills. They're very exciting bills, as you can see. And that's how we got from the 2014 law to these four bills, which are before you today.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. I'm Judy Gears, Deputy Chief Counsel, General Counsel Division, Oregon Department of Justice. Thank you for inviting us. Mr. Rettlinger from Legislative Counsel's Office has covered everything that needs to be covered here, in my view. I'm happy to answer questions about the DOJ process, although I was not personally involved with that. Steve Wolf, who is my boss, so he's the chief counsel at the General Counsel Division, personally was involved in this entire process. He was unable to be here today, so asked me to step in. The one thing that Steve wanted you to know is that the statutes targeted here are the low-hanging fruit. They are the obvious changes. For instance, Y2K. Been there, done that, don't need a statute about it anymore, right? A lot of, all of the changes here are, in our view, no-brainers. So we're happy to answer questions. The second time through on this, on 2017, it's going to be a slightly more difficult process because we did all the easy ones in this one. And as Legislative Counsel pointed out, to the extent that agencies were at all uncomfortable with things identified as candidates for this cleanup process, those were weeded out. So what is before you right now are the things that Legislative Counsel, DOJ, and the agencies and various other folks that we consulted with all agreed were just the obvious sort of low-hanging fruit here. So as I say, happy to answer questions, although I'm sure Ted would be a better resource for most of those. Thank you.
Questions? Yes.
I was just curious, does it make sense to delete the Y2K as we are approaching Y3K?
When we get there, we could probably put something better in place if we needed it.
Good idea.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair. Is there a similar process for administrative rules?
Chair Fagan, Representative Bueller, not that I know of. There may be something in the APA that directs agencies to periodically review their rules, but I don't know that answer off the top of my head.
Follow up?
Yes.
How would we find out if that's being done?
Representative Fagan, Representative Bueller, we could go back to our office and do that research and let you know.
Madam Chair, can I respond to Representative Bueller?
Yeah.
I do know that Senator Jackie Winters had a proposal to cause administrative rules to be reviewed. So that seems to indicate to me that there's not a good process in place for doing that right now. So maybe that is something we need to look into.
Thank you, Representative. Yes.
Well, not to pile on that subject matter too much, but I think most agencies have rulemaking authority. Otherwise, they wouldn't have rules to start with, and they periodically do go back and amend and change their rules to suit current day, statutes and their practices. And I am aware that of some that have eliminated rules that became obsolete as well. They just change them, and they do that in a public process and in public announcing that they're going to do a rulemaking and just create new rules that change them. So, anyway, just thought I'd add my two cents in. Thanks.
I see Mike. You guys can stay up here, but I saw Mike Ritchie. Did you want to come as well? Sorry, I didn't see the second sheet. I'm sorry. I should have had you come up for the first. So.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ritchie. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I work as General Counsel for the Child Support Program. So I'm here just to speak about a very unique part of 29, or very specific part of 2911. It's sections 20 through 23. It's one of the larger changes. It's like almost three pages of the bill, and we're repealing 18192 and making a bunch of conforming amendments that will essentially eradicate any reference to 18192 from the statutes. took a slightly different path here, but it ended up in the same place for the right reason. Last time I was returning from yet another hearing in which I had to convince the court that 18192 was obsolete, because it had been erroneously cited by someone yet again to suggest that certain judgments expire much sooner than they actually do, I decided it was time to see about having it repealed. And we proposed a standalone provision from DCS that was actually drafted, I think it was dropped yesterday, which is probably unnecessary given that since it qualified for the statutory cleanup process, it was also included in this bill. So that's how it ended up here. Just to give you a very brief background, the reason the statute existed and was necessary at one time is that prior to 1994, child support judgments could be enforced for 25 years and renewed for an additional 10, so they had a 35-year period of enforcement. Starting in 1994, they could no longer be renewed, so they were only enforceable for 25 years. 18192 was enacted just to make it clear that those older judgments could continue to be enforced for 35 years. You can read the statute all day, and you're not going to know that from the words that are actually in the statute. You have to go back and read all the legislative history and see all the changes that have occurred over the course of time to get that. And that's the reason it's so frequently miscited. But that's the reason for it. I appreciate the chance to be here, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Ritchie? Okay, I think that's it. Well, I can definitely attest to how thoroughly you guys did this, because I've got to say, in my very short service in the legislature, these are probably the most foremost boring bills I've ever read. So usually when you skip to the bold part, that's the exciting stuff, but nope, not in these bills. That's so thank you for being thorough. It was interesting to pass that, the kind of the enacting legislation, which we weren't really sure what it was going to look like last session, so glad to see the process make its way. So you guys can go ahead and be dismissed. I don't have anyone else signed up, but is there anyone else who'd like to testify on 2910, 2911, 2912, or 2913? Okay, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2910, 2911, 2912, and 2913. And I think that we actually got through it all. I was kind of doubtful. I want to wait because I don't know when Bob Russell's amendment will be. And we're definitely not going to do them Tuesday because we've got a pretty full plate Tuesday. So, okay, is there anything else for the good of the order? Welcome, Representative McLean. Oh, dive right into the deep end. Okay, great. Well, with that, I'm going to close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.